Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Wouldn't it be amazing if there was never a line at your favorite coffee shop, if Uber never had surcharges, and if avocados still cost 89 cents at the grocery store and not almost $2? Our daily lives go much more smoothly when there is a decent balance of supply and demand. Shortages can bring minor annoyances and delays, but when we're talking about healthcare, they can prevent you from getting the medical care you need now. On today's show, we'll explore shortages that affect our health, our environment, our way of life, and even potentially our enjoyment of ice cream. Let's start with a shortage that's affecting parents and children all over the country. Imagine your kid is in the middle of a mental health crisis. You're trying to get help urgently. So you get on the phone and you call and you call and you call, and you simply cannot get an appointment. A group of Harvard doctors did an experiment kind of like that a few years ago. They posed as the parents of a 12-year-old with depression. They reached out to hundreds of child psychiatrists across the country, and only a few had openings, and the average wait time was nearly a month and a half. There's a serious shortage of child psychiatrists, and Alana Gordon brings us the story of how we got there and how some are trying to find creative workarounds to this problem.
Andy Fu walks through the psychiatric wing of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia for a lunchtime discussion with fellow doctors in training.
I think part of my motivation to go into child psychiatry is, like, I was such a weird kid. Like, I was, like, comic book reading, anime drawing, like, weird.
Actually, Andy's badge even shows her comic book reading roots. Her lanyard has Dr. Harley Quinn on it. That's the infamous partner to that all-time villain, the Joker.
Because she's like the most famous psychiatrist that kids know.
Oh, yeah. Do kids react to it?
Yes. Their parents have no idea what it is.
Andy just completed her residency training in child psychiatry. She's part of the new generation, a small one, of adolescent and child psychiatrists entering this very strained workforce. Still, choosing this specialty was a no-brainer for Andy. She says growing up is such a vulnerable, critical time.
I'm surprised anybody survives. And I think putting yourself in position to kind of help kids through that and put them in the best possible place so that they can, you know, live the life they want to live and be happy, I think that's a great thing to spend my time doing, and I hope that other people would too.
But the thing is, a lot of other people don't want to do it, and that's been going on for a long time. Donna Shalala called it in a press conference almost 20 years ago.
We believe it's a public health crisis.
At that time, Shalala was the Health and Human Services Secretary in the Bill Clinton administration. She outlined the crisis in a groundbreaking report. It described a dearth of child psychiatrists to treat a growing number of kids with debilitating mental illnesses like depression, anxiety disorder, ADD. 2 decades later,
the situation then was distressingly similar to what it is now.
That's Dr. Gregory Fritz. He chaired a task force following the Shalala report to come up with solutions. But
actually, all our work hasn't made much of a dent.
He says from the get-go, the odds were stacked against them. Training for child psychiatry is longer than other specialties, and the salaries are lower. So spend more and then earn less. That's just a hard sell. Gregory is still banging his head against the wall to come up with solutions, all the while juggling his own backlogged practice.
And it feels terrible to tell somebody who's in crisis that we can see your child in a month. Who wants to do that? That's horrible.
This all sounds familiar to Dr. Tammy Benton. She's the chief of psychiatry at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Right now, she has 16 child psychiatrists in training. It's not going to be anywhere near enough.
The average age of a child psychiatrist is about 55, so the workforce is aging, but the number of people coming in to replace them is not increasing very rapidly.
Tammy says first, there just aren't enough slots to train the child psychiatrists we need. But even with that number,
there's more slots than there are people to fill them.
She says med students don't get much exposure to psychiatry, and it's just not a popular specialty. And that means pediatricians, like Dr. Stephen Shapiro, are having to fill a very big void.
Hello. It's nice to see your smiley face for a change.
Yes.
That's good.
Stephen has a practice in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and on a recent afternoon, he meets with a patient he's known since she was born. She's in high school now, but her life took a dark turn this winter.
How long have we been seeing each other for this? When did you first start coming to me?
In December.
At the time, she was crippled by severe anxiety. She didn't want to see friends anymore or go out at all. She fell behind in school. Here in this practice, Stephen sees mental health concerns surface a lot. He screens for it, too.
You feel well?
Yeah.
Sleeping okay?
Better than I was, yes.
Much better than you were.
Yeah.
Right.
Whether or not pediatricians are trained in mental health, they're being forced to respond. At the same time, the stigma of mental illness is decreasing, and more patients are coming to them asking for help.
The biggest challenge that I have faced in my recent career has been to learn about how to deal with these kinds of emotional, social, anxiety-related disorders. There's a lot of docs that haven't learned about these things.
And that can be a problem. Training to be a child psychiatrist takes a long time for a reason. This is a complicated field, and without that training, pediatricians are at a disadvantage when it comes to diagnosing and treating mental illnesses. And that treatment can include powerful medicines on a child's developing brain. Stephen says traditional pediatric training never included much about mental health. He's had to learn on his own about drugs and other treatments for conditions like depression and anxiety. And taking on mental health is time-consuming. These are longer conversations.
Here's the reality. This visit costs me a lot of time, 15, 20, 25 minutes. I don't get paid for this visit any more than I do for seeing a child with an earache. As a matter of fact, if I see more kids with earaches, I'll make more money than I do for seeing this young adult and helping to understand her situation. That's the problem with behavioral health.
And when kids have more complicated problems or multiple ones, which happens, Stephen needs help. He knows he has limitations in what he can do. But again, that specialized help isn't easy to find.
The referral path is convoluted and complicated and is based on individual relationships.
So Stephen is working with a group of pediatricians across the region on a different model of care that's been gaining traction lately. The idea is to better integrate mental health services into pediatric practices. Stephen hopes once their group launches, they'll have a psychiatrist available within their network of pediatricians throughout the area.
If I could have somebody here, that to me is the essence of what we need.
The Affordable Care Act paved the way for this approach with new reimbursement options. And more than 24 states have been experimenting with another way to help ease the pressure. It's a virtual support system for pediatricians. When they hit a situation they can't handle or are unsure about, they can dial up a number and get guidance from a child psychiatrist. It's called TIPS in Pennsylvania, and Dr. Evelyn Reese, a pediatrician in Pittsburgh, loves it.
Oh, my heavens. I joke sometimes that I have TIPS on speed dial, but that's not really a joke.
Evelyn says this system of virtual handholding gives her the backup she needs to make good decisions.
I'm comfortable prescribing medicines that are new to my prescribing practice if I have the backup of a psychiatrist, especially someone that I can call on the phone anytime I need them and know that they'll be there for me.
These approaches are offering backup to pediatricians on the front line. But their success depends on actually finding a psychiatrist to work with. And that's the big problem. Again, not enough medical residents are choosing child psychiatry.
Yes, there's a giant shortage that seems to be getting bigger.
Andy Fu, that new child psychiatry graduate, is one of the few exceptions.
How do you feel going into that?
Personally, I feel great because I feel like I'm doing what I can to help out. Part of my career trajectory is probably going to include what I can of interacting with medical students and trying to get more of them to go into child psychiatry.
She says yes, the long training and the lower salary will be a deal breaker for some, but she thinks it's more than that. Early intervention in mental illness, like any disease, can make a real difference. But that mental health intervention is not always an easy fix, and doctors like to fix things.
Whereas in psychiatry, you sort of just have to be okay with, I tried my best, I hope that worked. half the time it's not, half the time my patients don't want anything to do with me. And that's extremely uncomfortable, I think, for a lot of non-psychiatry physicians.
She says she's well aware of the challenges of the field, of the shortages and the pressures she's about to step into. But for her, that's all the more reason to jump right in. The success of future generations of young adults depends on it. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
And by the way, Andy Fu and her colleagues were super nervous about having Alana interview them, but as shrinks, they have tools to deal with that.
So we are big believers in leaning into anxiety. That's yes. The whole child psychiatry thing.
Absolutely, yes.
More anxiety, that's how you know you're challenging yourself. If you're never anxious, yeah. Then you finish growing, right? If you never tried something that made you nervous, then you stop trying new things. And that's terrible.
We're talking about shortages on The Pulse today, and let's stick with healthcare. When a person arrives in the hospital after a sexual assault, they might be taken care of by somebody called a SANE, a sexual assault nurse examiner. These are forensic nurses who can take care of the patient's medical needs while also getting a precise history of what happened, documenting injuries, and collecting evidence for a rape kit. They also often have to testify in court. It's a critical job, but only about 17% of hospitals in the U.S. have this kind of program. I talked to Sally Lasky. She's the CEO of the International Association of Forensic Nurses, and I asked her how this shortage could affect patients.
The first person that a trauma survivor reaches out to and what that interaction ends up being, how that person responds, ultimately tends to shift the path of what services they may seek out or who they may tell their story to in the future. Individuals that receive care from a SANE are more likely to have better evidence collected. Their cases are more likely to be prosecuted, and their healthcare needs have been met.
So what is it like to do this job? Here's Debbie Holbrook, Director of Forensic Nursing at Mercy Medical Center in Baltimore, and this is how she starts her conversations with her patients.
My name is Debbie. I'm going to take really good care of you today. You are safe with me, and I believe you. And that's for every patient that I have that's not unconscious. That's how I greet every single patient. They're horrific cases. Just absolutely horrific cases. I have case after case of young people who are given date rape drugs, and they wake up and they don't know where they are and their clothes are missing. I have young girls who are raped by mom's boyfriends. And I had a young boy one time who was sold out as the prize when dad did poker games. So I mean, these are just a few examples. I am on a good day, 15 minutes away from the hospital. When I park, I will sit in the parking garage and I will take a couple minutes just to deep breathe, and I say a prayer for the victim. I say a prayer for the entire team of people who are coming in to take care of that person, and that I make a difference in their life. I conduct the forensic examination. I take pictures, I collect swabs, I do a medical assessment of their body. I see if there's medicines they need to keep them from getting pregnant or to keep them from getting any diseases. And then they're discharged. And then I sit for hours and package evidence and write my report and look for injuries on the pictures and put them on trauma diagrams. And it weighs, you know, these things, they build up. They build up, and it's layers and layers and layers of all these kind of cases. Right now, I am in therapy for the third time in my career, where I have realized, you know, you have to notice those changes in yourself. You have to notice, you know, that you're not being as kind, not to patients, but just in general. I'm always the kind of person where somebody says, "How you doing today?" And I'm like, "I am great." And then all of a sudden, a few months ago, I noticed, you know what? Somebody said to me, "How you doing today?" And I said, "You really want to know? You really want to know? Because I can tell you how I'm doing, and I'm doing good." And so I realized it was just time to get to somebody and unload some of it. To decompress from this work, I have learned that I have to totally separate myself. I do things like meditation, prayer. My husband, for my birthday this month, gave me a hot tub. That's a big deal when you need somewhere to go to drown out the voices. You can't get these thoughts out of your head sometimes. Some of them you can let go. But some of them just, they're with you all the time. And then you're going, then you think, okay, I'm over some of these worst cases. I'm good. I've moved on. And then your subpoena comes. And now your subpoenas are coming left and right because now you've got court cases. And sometimes I've got 40 cases that on top of all the new drama that's coming in, I've got all of these ones that I have to keep revisiting. There's not a lot of people like me out there who have been doing this work for many, many years. There's a handful of us in the United States right now that have kept doing this. The difference that I make, one life at a time when they leave you, it's powerful, and somebody's got to do it.
That's Debbie Holbrook. She is director of forensic nursing at Mercy Medical Center in Baltimore. And before we heard from Debbie, we were talking with Sally Lasky from the Association of Forensic Nurses about some of the challenges that come with this job, which is part of the reason there's a shortage of these very highly skilled nurses. And Sally, it sounds like this job could just be too much to bear.
We have learned so much about trauma and about the neurobiology of trauma, and in addition, about the vicarious trauma that many care providers experience. Sitting with people and hearing their stories of trauma changes our brains. Those stories become part of who we are, and the work often does feel isolating. We're really working to help recenter the work of SANES as a key healthcare process, which means that the healthcare providers need to be healthy themselves to be able to provide the best care possible.
Are patients sometimes turned away from hospitals if they don't have the right person on staff to deal with the situation?
Unfortunately, yes. We do hear quite regularly that patients have been turned away if there isn't someone on staff that has been trained to do a medical forensic examination. This should never happen.
Because I'm thinking, if you get turned away, maybe you'll just go home.
Absolutely. Many people do turn away thinking that, oh, well, if it's not important enough for them to have someone to provide me care, or sometimes folks feel like they weren't believed by hospital staff and turn away. I think that's why it is really important that we look at this as a community issue. Forensic nurses, SANES, don't operate in a vacuum. It really does require a community partnership with other providers like victim advocates, so that no matter what door someone walks in, all of those people will be able to help open additional doors to make sure that folks get comprehensive care that they need.
Sally Lasky is the CEO of the International Association of Forensic Nurses. Think about what's in your grocery bags every week. Fruit, veggies, meat if you eat it, maybe some almonds, hummus, chips, cereal bars. More than 80% of what we eat in the U.S. is grown here, and the farmers producing all of that food are getting older. The average farmer is 58 years old, and that number is climbing. That's no age to be doing a lot of backbreaking work all day long, but if you have a smaller farm, that's how it is. We have a shortage of young people going into farming, and there's a surprising challenge getting in their way. Alan Yu explains.
27-year-old Frank Carrillo is bent over and wielding a knife It's 10 a.m. and he's been working for 4 hours already because it's harvest day on the 10-acre organic farm that he owns with a partner. He's cutting off broccoli crowns.
So basically we're just going to go like a couple inches down and cut on an angle.
He does this for a row of broccoli, cutting the crowns and breaking off the leaves until his wheelbarrow is full.
We've got, for this week, Swiss chard, lacinato kale, Italian dandelion greens, turnips, broccoli.
Business is good for him. Around 200 families have paid for shares of his harvest, and they pick produce regularly. Frank also sells his produce at a farmer's market, some local restaurants, and a Whole Foods supermarket in the area. And today, he's meeting more potential new customers. A couple of chefs are opening a new restaurant in the fall, and they're visiting the farm because they want to buy local produce. Frank digs up a couple of carrots, wipes off the dirt on his shirt, and lets them have a taste. The chefs are impressed.
Dude, look at this! Jesus Christ, like... Starburst, my friend. Oh, man.
Local produce continues to be a big trend in restaurants, but farming, the job, isn't that popular.
It's funny, we joke around all the time about PSAs about telling your family you're going to be a farmer, because it's just this such a weird thing, you know? You went to college to not do manual labor. There's this, like, stigma with doing manual labor.
Frank studied political science in college, thinking he would go into environmental law, but he loves farming. However, he still has student loans to pay off, and that's a problem because farming doesn't pay that much.
We are staring down the barrel of a crisis in the farm population.
That's Andrew Barenberg from the National Young Farmers Coalition. A few years ago, they surveyed 700 people in the coalition, and 30% said they are not farming or can't start their own farm because it wouldn't be enough to pay off their student loan debt. And a lot of experts agree we need young farmers now more than ever. Jim Ladley from the Penn State Extension works with a lot of farmers and studies what they do. He says with climate change and more extreme weather events, it's really important for farmers to go to school and learn how to grow more diverse crops and choose the right varieties that can survive droughts or floods.
Doing the same thing or growing the same crop for 30 years is not likely going to be successful in the future, would be my best guess. We're going to need scientists and science-based farms in the future, for sure.
For example, Jim says that if you're a dairy farmer now, you can get more than 130 data points every day for every cow. How active the cow is, how much food it's eating, and so on. And if you grow crops, well, a lot of farmers now use drones to get a bird's eye view of their fields to see if they can target specific areas that need pesticides, as opposed to the old method of just spraying the entire field.
There's just a lot more to it than there ever has been. A lot of science involved today and a lot of management of data.
One idea to solve the problem is to address student loans directly and just forgive the loans of young farmers after 10 years of paying back the debt. This is already the case for public service workers like nurses and police officers. There's a bipartisan bill in the House to do that. It's called the Young Farmer Success Act. New York State already has a program to forgive up to $50,000 of student loan debt for graduates who farm full-time for at least 5 years. But for the House bill, you would have to count farming as a public service.
I didn't sign up to serve my country for the paycheck. You sign up for it because, you know, you love what you do and you love to serve, and that you put this country before yourself. And that's just how I look at farming.
That's Davon Goodwin. He got into farming in North Carolina after he joined the army, served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and got hit by a bomb. He says farming is a public service.
You know, being a farmer to me is no less than being a soldier, a nurse. I mean, they're all the same. They all have the same high importance in society because you're giving yourself to serve your community, which you could be doing something totally different.
There is one big obstacle for the Young Farmer Success Act. Even if farming gets added to the list of jobs covered by the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, the Trump administration's education budget would cut that program. For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our appetites can create shortages. think about avocados. Thanks, millennials, with your avocado toast. I'm kidding. Or almonds, both crops where demand is outpacing supply and prices are going up. Consumption can also have serious implications for ecosystems. That's certainly true for fish. We're hearing so much about overfishing these days, it's hard to know what you can still eat and feel okay about. I talked to marine ecologist Emily Klein about overfishing. She is with the Farallon Institute. That's an organization that studies marine ecosystems.
There definitely are areas where fish stocks are overfished, where people do have to be cautious about which fish they end up choosing to consume. Some of the additional issues are there are definitely areas where there's illegal fishing going on or unreported fishing going on. Also a lot of bycatch, where people catch the wrong thing and end up having to throw that catch back, which is kind of a lose-lose both for the marine ecosystem and for fishermen.
How do you define overfishing? What does that mean, and who's tracking that?
So overfishing, for me as a marine scientist, does have a specific definition. And it does mean a stock or a fish population that is currently below what are called biologically sustainable levels. And that is analytically driven. We do assess that regionally or locally.
Can you give me an example of an area, place in the country where overfishing is happening?
Sure. So I think the area that I am most familiar with, because it's the area that I have studied, is the Gulf of Maine, which is the body of water right here off of New England. And there's a lot of controversy and struggles around Atlantic cod, which has been a staple of New England for, you know, decades to centuries here. And it's at historically low levels here in the Gulf of Maine, which is a problem both for the marine ecosystem because it's an important predatory fish there, but it's also an issue for our communities because, you know, codfish and fishing is part of our New England heritage. And for me, I study kind of long-term ecosystem changes as part of my research. And in that case, you know, I'm looking at what was going on in the Gulf of Maine 50 or 100 years ago. And that's when we see really the numbers of codfish being orders of magnitude more than what we see today in the Gulf of Maine, not just codfish, some of the other species as well.
And what are the reasons for this overfishing? Bigger fishing boats, like what's happening?
So there's several trends to that. Certainly one of them is ramping up of technology and boat size, going from originally fishing codfish from various, you know, sail vessels and lines with hooks and lines, moving into now we have very industrial vessels that can fish at much higher impact than kind of those sail vessels, obviously. But laying on top of all of that is climate change. So the Gulf of Maine is warming, is one of the places that's warming the fastest globally. And so we have climate change also impacting cod.
A lot of people want to eat more fish because they think it's more sustainable for the planet. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to eat a lot of meat and they think eating fish is just a better option. Right. Doesn't seem like that's totally true.
I wish that people would take the kind of care some of us take to eating, to making the choices that we make, to what they take from the sea as well. And they took the kind of time to research those issues as well. I don't think they should stop eating fish. I think that, you know, I care a lot about fishing communities as well. And if we say we're not going to fish, then we lose those communities. So we want to find ways to both sustain marine ecosystems and sustain our fishing communities.
Do you think we care less about fish because we're not as emotionally attached to them as we are perhaps to mammals like cows or pigs, you know, that are cute and cuddly?
I think that's probably a part of the issue. It's hard to ask me that because I care about fish. So I care about them about the same. But I think that's part of it. I also think that people often have an attitude that they look at the ocean and it seems to be unchanging and it feels like it's so big, there's no way we can actually have an impact. I think that's the other part of it, is that people don't realize that we do have an impact on the ocean and on fish stocks. And there are things that we could be doing better.
Emily Klein is a marine ecologist with the Farallon Institute. She's also a fly fisher, which is a pretty low impact method of getting fish out of the waterways, if I've ever seen one. Sorry. You never catch a fish. It's just like hours and what's it? I can say it in the clean.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY. Cancer pushes us. We push back. Cancer Treatment Centers of America is challenging conventional thinking and is working to find smarter solutions. With 5 treatment centers located throughout the United States, CTCA is forging ahead with technology that wasn't available to cancer patients just a short time ago. More at cancercenter.com/outsmart.
We're talking about shortages today, and there certainly is no shortage of braggy vacation pictures on my Instagram feed. Seems like everybody is in South Africa or at some fancy beach. So we all love our summer vacations. You know who doesn't, who's not excited about this time of year? Blood banks. They rely on blood drives at schools and offices to replenish their supply. So when school lets out and employees go on vacation, there's less blood to go around. Jake J. Smith reports.
Raul Mora's job gets a lot more stressful in the summertime. So as a way to kick back, he plays baseball, third base and pitcher.
I play with Chicago North. I play with the Sea Dogs. It's a 53 and over team.
In Chicago, Raul oversees the distribution of blood to 10 hospitals, and he knows exactly when to expect the summer slowdown.
We saw it a little earlier this year. I don't know if it's because our transfusions are up, or if people just started leaving for vacations early, or if they changed the school calendar. I really don't know, but we started seeing it probably 2 weeks before Memorial Day.
Raul shows me a huge walk-in refrigerator at the Red Cross. Can we go inside there?
Sure.
There are yellow plastic bins holding pints of blood, but about 80% of the shelves are empty.
And it's built to accommodate up to 5,000 products, but there's only 1,000, so it's not good.
This is about half as much blood as Raul usually keeps in stock. And this drop happens every year. They can't stockpile earlier in the year before summer hits because red blood cells only last about 45 days in the fridge. After that, they start breaking down.
Once it hits that shelf life, those products are no good. We have to throw them out.
How bad does this problem get? The Red Cross says nationwide, its donations decrease by about 6% in the summer. Other blood distributors say their donations drop 10, even 20%. Now, to be clear, nobody is dying from these blood shortfalls. When stocks run low, blood suppliers will hustle and work with hospitals to make sure the blood goes wherever it's needed most. But you have to wonder, if blood suppliers are so desperate for more donations in the summer, and the shortage predictably happens every year, maybe it would help if they paid people to give blood.
We think that the evidence is pretty clear that this could be a way to solve when there's temporary shortages.
That's Bob Slonim. He's an economist at the University of Sydney who studies altruism and blood markets. Because blood is essentially a commodity. Organizations like the Red Cross are taking your donated blood and selling it to hospitals. So why not give blood donors a cut of that money? It's perfectly legal in the U.S. to pay people for their blood. In fact, for much of the 20th century, that's how it worked. Then in 1970, a social policy researcher named Richard Titmuss published a book called The Gift Relationship. In the book, he argued that paying people for their blood might attract the wrong kind of folks.
Maybe people who can't hold a steady job, and so these might be people that have issues with alcohol or with drugs, that would actually make their blood less safe.
In the book, Titmuss argued that it's just better to rely on people's good charitable instincts. Soon after, organizations like the Red Cross and the World Health Organization started advocating for volunteer-only blood donation, which brings us to the system we have now. But recently, economist Bob Slonim and other researchers put this theory to the test. They did several studies to find out what happens when you give people incentives, like a $10 gift card or a t-shirt. And they found that these incentives worked. More people did donate. And as far as safety?
We never found that when the incentives were offered, we saw any increase in people being disqualified to donate blood.
Bob's research team wasn't able to offer blood donors money, just small gifts. So I wanted to know, how would blood donors feel about getting paid cold, hard cash for their blood? I visited a blood drive in downtown Chicago to ask a few people, and most of them said, no thanks, like Brenda Thompson.
So you're telling me if you got $20, you wouldn't do it more frequently?
No, honestly, really,
whenever I can give blood, that's what I'm going to do.
Another blood donor, John Merman, had other more creative ideas. Like maybe they could hold the blood drive on the observation deck of the Willis Tower, a famous Chicago tourist destination where you can look out over the city.
Donation with a view. Or serve cocktails. Not that that idea would ever fly.
Can you imagine how woozy people would get?
Yeah, well, might be entertaining too.
That's not likely to happen. So far, there hasn't been enough demand or worry to change the system. But over the years, scientists have been looking for a scientific breakthrough that could change how things are done. One of the latest attempts is from Alan Doctor, a physician and researcher at Washington University in St. Louis. He's the creator of Erythromer.
So it's an artificial red blood cell that's intended to resuscitate people who might be severely anemic or bleeding.
Erythromer is a pink powder that you would mix with water. It's designed to be injected into someone's bloodstream. Erythromer hasn't even been tested in humans yet, but the big idea is that it could be used on soldiers who are wounded on the battlefield, where real blood might be hard to store. And it could also help hospitals and blood banks deal with seasonal shortages. For instance, when someone is rushed to the emergency room after a major accident, doctors could give them the powdered substitute to stabilize the patient, freeing up real blood for other uses. It could also come in handy in a major incident like the Boston Marathon bombing.
Boston area hospitals went to the brink of depleting the local blood bank with that disaster. And we have discussed with government agencies the possibility of stockpiling Erythromer in urban centers.
In the future, could all of the blood we need come from a lab instead of from people? Physician Alan Doctor says that's a long ways off. Erythromer is not a perfect substitute for blood. It doesn't clot or fight infection or circulate like real blood does. For now, we'll have to continue to depend on people lining up to donate. For The Pulse, I'm Jake J. Smith.
Every time a new scientific discovery happens, researchers who want to get their findings published have to send their work along to other scientists to check it out. This is called peer review.
So imagine Apple sending out their tablet to Google and Amazon and so forth and saying, hey, this is our new tablet. Why don't you guys critique it? Help us make sure that we're following industry standards. Provide ways that we might make it better, or if we left out something, tell us that so we can improve it. That's kind of how the peer review process works.
That's Brooks Hansen. He's vice president for publications at the American Geophysical Union. He helps work with scientists to publish peer-reviewed papers on subjects like geology, climate change, space. And finding those peer reviewers can be a challenge. So one of your colleagues could tap you to review their paper. How much work does that mean for you? What do you have to do?
It could be, you know, a day's worth of work, depending on how much I know about the paper, how long the paper is, how complex the analysis becomes that I have to do to evaluate the paper and to provide feedback and critique and suggestions.
And do you get paid for that service?
So generally, no. And on the scale of it, there's, you know, about 1 million papers published or so a year across the sciences. And so each of those gets reviewed by at least 2 referees and many more than that. So probably, you know, somewhere on the order of 4 million reviews or so across the sciences.
Wow. So would you say there is a shortage of reviewers?
You know, what we're finding is that the distribution of research is created almost equally worldwide now between North America, Asia, Europe, and the various leading countries that are doing research. But the peer review pool, or the reviewers, tend to be dominated or most across most leading journals in still North America and Europe, and they tend to be more senior scientists.
You recently published an article about female peer reviewers. What did you find?
We looked at the database of our 20 journals for the past 3 years, and we were able to match it to our member database, which gave us age information as well. So what we found was that women of most ages were asked less and suggested less as reviewers than men. And that has a number of important implications, because being a reviewer also, it's not just that you're critiquing and helping the science, and we want to expand the diversity of viewpoints shaping or providing input into scientific knowledge, but you also connect with other scientists, you connect with editors, you connect with thought leaders. So it's that gap is important to correct.
What do you think has to happen so that the entire pool of potential reviewers out there is tapped?
It's a real challenge to identify, you know, and foster good young scientists. We do a bunch of exercises on or workshops on peer review and how to be a reviewer. One of the little experiments were in response to our study in on gender in Nature is that we're now doing an experiment on one of our journals of trying to remind authors when they're suggesting reviewers and our editors of specifically thinking about diversity in the peer review. So by adding an extra reviewer, it may sound like we're making the burden worse, but we're actually trying to train reviewers by recognizing and bringing them on as additional reviewers.
Brooks Hansen is the Vice President for Publications at the American Geophysical Union. We've been talking about shortages on the show today, and right now I'm sitting in the studio with three tubs of vanilla ice cream. I wanted to make sure I have enough because I'm going to do a little tasting experiment, and I do think I need somebody to taste this with me. How about our intern, Liz Tung? Come on in here. Hey, Liz.
Hey.
Have a seat, please. So let's try ice cream number one, which has some real vanilla in it, real vanilla beans. It says it on the back here. Give this a try.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right. What do you think? It's good, right?
That's really good.
Right? Okay.
That's nice.
So we like this one. Mm-hmm. Now, this ice cream here says on the back that it does not have vanilla beans in it. I didn't see any. But it has natural vanilla flavors in it. So I'm not sure what that exactly
means.
I don't know, but here, have a try. See how you like that. It's good, but not quite as good, right?
It's no,
good,
definitely
though.
Not.
It's good.
All right.
Okay, and now I have to make you taste one more ice cream. It has natural and artificial flavors in it. So let's see what that's like.
It's a little lighter.
I think it tastes really good, though.
Yeah, it's better than the last one, I think.
Okay. Well, thank you, Liz. Sorry your job is so hard. But the reason I wanted to taste this ice cream is because there are different kinds of vanilla that are being used, or vanilla flavors, and there are some changes going on right now in the flavor industry. Here's Irina Zhorov with more.
Around the world, thousands of products contain vanilla flavor. But lately, there's been a shortage of the good stuff. What exactly is considered the good stuff? I wanted to start with the purist. Teresa Wall owns Tarte's Pastry Shop in Philadelphia. In her tiny pink bakery, she's preparing cannelés, French pastries flavored with rum and vanilla.
These are the vanilla beans. Right now, I just split the pea pod, the vanilla bean, in half. And I'm scraping out the seeds. And you know, you always try and get all of them because they are expensive.
She whisks the vanilla beans in a pot of heating milk to break them up. Then she cracks eggs into flour and sugar. Finally, she pours the hot milk into the flour batter.
That smells so good.
Yeah, it does.
What percentage of what you make would you say actually uses vanilla?
Oh, I would say at least 75% of what we make has vanilla.
Teresa uses real vanilla, which comes from an orchid and is mostly grown in Madagascar. When storms or other problems strike the island, prices spike. Sometimes she gets half a pound of beans for $30, other times it's $75. But 99% of the quote-unquote vanilla we eat globally is not the stuff Teresa uses. Vanilla has a bunch of flavor components, but it's possible to isolate the main chemical, called vanillin, in a lab to make vanilla flavor. That's mostly what we eat when we get vanilla wafers or vanilla coffee creamers. Nadia Berenstein, a flavor historian, says vanilla flavor was first made in Germany in the 1870s.
Two chemical researchers figured out how to synthesize it from a compound called coniferin, which is basically found in the sap of different kinds of evergreens.
It's possible to get vanillin from vanilla beans, but you can also use other things. Over the years, scientists have produced vanillin from coal tar, wood bark, paper pulp, clove oil, fossil fuels. Whatever the source, vanillin is vanillin.
A chemist will tell you that they're identical.
On a box of cookies or a carton of ice cream, though, flavor labeling gets complicated. If the vanilla flavor comes from spices, botanicals, fruits, or vegetables, it's labeled as natural vanilla flavor. Most of our vanilla flavor today comes from petrochemicals, which has to be labeled as an artificial flavor. Lately, companies like Hershey's and Nestle have been vowing to stick with natural flavors. Consumers demand it. The problem? Not only is there not enough vanilla bean, there's not enough of the so-called natural vanilla flavor to go around. Companies are exploring new methods to make the flavor. Christina Agapakis works for one of these, Ginkgo Bioworks.
We know a lot about the enzymes responsible for producing flavors in plants.
The company takes flavor-making mechanisms from plants and puts them in a yeast. Feed the yeast a little sugar, and voila, it pumps out your desired flavor. If they succeed in making vanillin this way, will it be natural?
I like to think of it as a third category. It's a biological flavor. It's a cultured ingredient. I think the distinctions that we draw between natural and artificial are themselves pretty artificial. There's a lot of nuance.
There's nuance in taste, too. Often, we just prefer whatever flavor we grew up eating. Teresa Wall, for one, says she'll keep using real vanilla. Back at her shop, Teresa's cannolis are done.
Just like Oreos, I have certain ways that I always eat the top first. It's super crispy because all of the vanilla seeds are sitting up there at the top, and then you get this like really intense flavor, and that's probably my favorite part.
That was Teresa Wall, vanilla lover and owner of Tarte's pastry shop in Philadelphia. Irina Zhorov reported this story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Alan Yu. He visited a farm for his story and learned what it takes to get started in this job.
My first day of farming ever was in this plot here, actually, and there used to be raspberries here, and for like 6 hours straight on like a sunny summer day, I was just weeding the raspberries. And you know, they didn't explicitly say this, but I'm definitely sure it was to like feel me out and see if I could handle it.
So like farmer hazing?
Yeah, kind of.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We had help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. Liz Tung is our intern. Charlie Kyer, our engineer. Paige Flager is our associate producer. Tanya English, our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Neurosciences. At Penn Neurosciences, brain and spine specialists work together to help people break through the darkness of their disease. From delivering clinical research to finding new approaches to treat MS and epilepsy to developing advanced procedures for brain and spine disorders, the Penn Neurosciences team cares for each patient and their individual needs. More information is available at pennmedicine.org/neuro. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.